My name's Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute. You're listening to The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of The Monthly and The Saturday Paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The Saturday Paper's my source of quality long-form journalism every weekend. The Monthly's the country's best magazine of politics, culture and ideas. They even publish some of mine from time to time. This week I'll be talking to Jane Carrow about education, Karen Middleton about what, if anything, we can learn from the Weinstein affair here in Australia, and debating the merits of public and private school funding with Chris Fry in our Sensible Centre segment. Now I'm joined by Karen Middleton, the Saturday Paper's chief political correspondent and a long-time observer of Parliament. Karen, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Thanks, Richard.
Look, a year ago, you wrote a very important piece about sexual harassment in the Canberra Press Gallery. And, of course, in the last week, we've seen that it's not just confined to the Canberra Press Gallery.
No.
What's your reaction to what's happening around the world in response to the Weinstein behaviour?
Well, it's interesting. The piece I wrote a year ago this week, which is kind of weird, was in response to the Donald Trump back-of-the-bus conversation with Billy Bush, that Hollywood tape that emerged during the presidential campaign in the United States a year ago. And my point in writing the piece, which was I was encouraged by my editor, Eric Jensen, to do it, was to make the point that it is common. It's not just Hollywood. And similarly, it's not just politics. It's not just any particular vocation. This kind of harassment happens in all walks of life, on the street, in the bus, in a shopping centre, at the doctor's surgery. It can happen all over the place. And so the point in writing that piece was to say it's terribly common. And I think it's interesting to me that we've seen this, morph from the Weinstein case right across the world in the last few days, with this hashtag MeToo that's appearing on social media, which is about women, mostly women, sometimes it's men, but largely we're talking about women putting their hands up and saying, yeah, actually I've been harassed or even worse, I've been assaulted, just to give it an indication of exactly how common and how normal, in inverted commas, it's become and how unacceptable that is.
And what was the reaction you got when you wrote that piece?
It was huge, and I was a bit apprehensive. Eric asked me to do it because we'd had a conversation about the Trump thing, and the fact that he and this Hollywood host had this kind of boys' club conversation about women, and Donald Trump had said that he liked to grab them by the pussy and that you could get away with anything when you were famous and they would let you do it. And then they said some derogatory things about a woman they were about to work with, and then, you saw them get off the bus and be all sweet and nice to her. And I was commenting on that and saying, that sort of thing's happened to me. And Eric said, why don't you write about it? And I was apprehensive because I thought, well, I'm just going to get caned on social media. The trolls are everywhere. I'll get a free character analysis, a free physical analysis, all the unwanted attention. Do I really want that? And you realise the more you think about these incidents in your own life that you actually have parked them somewhere away, locked them up in a dark place. And it was interesting when I read the New Yorker piece about some women talking about their encounters with Harvey Weinstein. One of them had described exactly the same thing. And what I found when I did write about it was all these women came forward and said, it's made me think about things that have happened to me. And they all described a similar experience of things having happened. You rationalise them. They might have humiliated you at the time, made you feel small, made you feel sick, made you feel ashamed, and then they lock them away somewhere in the back of their minds, and it's not until something like this happens and it's a public discussion that you sort of unlock that and it comes out. And so I did write a second piece the following week about it, because all these women were coming and the format of their responses was all the same. I just need to tell you what happened to me. Here's what happened when I was 6. Here's what happened when I was 14, 23, 35. I got two messages from women who were in their 70s. One was in a nursing home and sent me a message indirectly through someone else to say congratulations for writing it and to talk about some things that had happened to her that she'd never discussed before. So I think this is a thing, that there are women everywhere who've had these experiences, who've just had to put them out of their minds and get on with life. And now we're starting to talk about it. There's a great deal of kind of recognition and discomfort.
Well, thank you for enduring that discomfort because, because I think it is important that unless people do speak out in that way, it is harder for other people to realise it wasn't just me. And and on this show, we've had a number of topics which have all come back, coincidentally, I'd suggest, to the issue of shame.
Mm.
People who are afraid to ask for help in mental health care.
Yep.
People who don't ask for help in the welfare system because they don't like the way welfare recipients are talked about. Yep. Shame has come up a number of times in this series, and you've just raised it again now. Do you think that the media can do a good job of telling those stories more effectively? Because we typically focus so much on the other side of the story.
Yeah.
What's it like to be powerful? That's the standard thing for the media to coverage, yet you've shown that it's very powerful and also very engaging for the audience to talk about the other side.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think what I wrote about in the second piece last year was that talking about it wasn't, from my point of view, wasn't about shaming anyone who was a perpetrator. People were saying to me at the time, name them, shame them, you know, and I hadn't put any names in the piece I had written. And I did that on purpose because most of these incidents were a really long time ago. Some of the people are dead now. Some politicians I had encounters with or you know, people in other walks of life. Some, you know, there isn't anyone still serving in Parliament that I wrote about. So I didn't want it to be about that. It was about sunlight. You know, it was about exposing this as an issue. It was about telling other women, yeah, it happens to me too. You can speak up and talk about it. And I think the thing is that it's so incidental and ordinary in our daily lives, the random encounter. I mean, I talked about in the first piece I wrote about encountering a man in the street who was walked up to me, and an older man, and I thought he was going to ask me for directions, and he leaned in and stuck his tongue down my throat. And it was so shocking, but so sort of ordinary as well in the street. What do you do about that? You're not going to go away and write a big feature about it. You feel like an idiot doing that. So you're just left feeling slightly ashamed and embarrassed and humiliated. So most of these examples are sort of like that, I guess, or, you know, there's the extremes of sexual assault and rape, which are in a separate category but part of the same cultural problem, that we don't tend to expose these individual things because they don't seem dramatic enough, but they're dramatic when they happen to you and what's happening now. And I think this is where the media can play a positive role, and they are, is in, and I'll include social media in that, is bringing the sunlight to this issue and is having women feel, I'm not alone in this. This has happened to lots of us. Maybe we have a cultural problem here right across the world, it seems, in the way, particularly the way men engage with women. It's, you know, flirting is not the same as this. Yeah. Harassment and flirting are not the same. There's mutual attraction, and flirting is innocuous usually and not a power game, but it is the issue of a power game and where it becomes intimidatory and humiliating, that is the problem.
Yeah, well, thank you. And again, I mean, what's clearly dramatic is how widespread this is, and I think the Me Too hashtag, if nothing else, has highlighted to not just a lot of women, to a lot of men.
Yeah.
This is dramatic in its proportion. Some of the incidents, as you said, might not seem dramatic enough to write a column about, but what's clearly newsworthy and what's clearly of interest to the public is how widespread this problem is, if not how appalling any particular instance is. The collected set of this clearly appalls most people.
I got a message from a man I know professionally through politics in the non-government organisations community. He wrote to me after that piece appeared, the first piece, and said, you know, I was just shocked and horrified that this could happen to you. And somehow I think he thought a person like me who deals with powerful people would never have to put up with this. And I don't get treated like that in that, certainly not in that circumstance in political life anymore, because I'm older. I'm probably not as attractive to some of those lecherous old men. They've got other people to prey on.
They were very attractive themselves.
Right, that's indeed. But, you know, so there's clearly a question about relative power here. Those things do still happen to all sorts of people. They don't necessarily happen to me. But we just need to talk about them a bit more. And he said, this guy said to me, I just was horrified that it could happen to someone like you, and it made me think, what about my teenage daughter? What if it happens to her? What if it already has and she hasn't told me about it? And so it clearly touched a nerve with some men who were saying, I just had no idea where it happens, who it happens to, and the extent of it.
So to wrap up, clearly this is something the country's talking about this week. Indeed, this is something the Western world is talking about this week. Is it something the Parliament's talking about this week?
I think in the corridors. And certainly we've seen references to it in the last couple of days. The issue of power and men and women has come up. It's come up in the context of Lisa Wilkinson leaving Channel 9. That's not a sexual harassment issue, but it's a pay parity issue, it seems. And some people are conflating those two things and saying, yeah, let's talk about women and men and the way they are dealt with in a professional context in the workplace. Why are they not treated equally, and why is there a culture that propels men and holds back women in whatever context, whether it be in terms of the culture of harassment that prevails, or whether it's I don't get paid as much as other people might. So in that sense, yes, it has been talked about in politics, and I think it's a good conversation to have.
Well, let's hope it keeps going. Karen Middleton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Richard.
Is public debt proof that a government is living beyond its means, or proof that it's investing in its future? It's a simple question, but with no simple answer. But because Australian public debate is so broken, Australian public debate now allows for no nuance. Voters are now forced to pick teams or just tune out from important debates, and it's obvious which most prefer.
This is the fundamental test for this Parliament. We are currently living beyond our means. We are in deficit. We are spending more than we're receiving in revenue. We are increasing debt. We cannot keep doing that.
Well, that was Malcolm Turnbull suggesting debt is some sort of proof that we're living beyond our means. But the fact is, Australians are some of the most indebted people in the world. We love debt. As a nation, we have huge mortgages, big credit card bills, and payday lenders and pawn shops are a permanent fixture on our television screens. Yet we're being told by conservative politicians and business leaders that government borrowing is some form of evidence of economic mismanagement. Proof that we're living beyond our means. Proof that we need to cut spending on things like health and education. But how can any politician with a mortgage believe for a second that debt means a person or an organisation is living beyond their means?
In this budget, we'll be making changes to the way we report government debt and link it to government spending by increasing the visibility in the budget between good and bad debt.
Well, that was Treasurer Scott Morrison trying to tell us that debt could be good or bad. Debt can't be good or bad. Debt is debt. What might be considered good or bad are the things that we decide to buy with borrowed money. I'd probably use words like better and worse rather than good or bad, but hey, that's me. One thing I can assure you of is that there isn't an economics textbook in the world that helps you tell the difference between good things and bad things. Indeed, the foundational assumption of neoliberal economics is that individuals, not politicians, are better placed to make decisions about what's good and what's bad, or what's better and what's worse. Some people think that borrowing money for a car is a good idea, and some people think it's a bad idea. As an economist, I don't have strong views either way, but I'd probably focus on questions like, if you didn't buy the car, what else would you do with the money? Or, will buying the car help you earn more money? Or, if you have to borrow money to buy the car, do you have to buy such an expensive one? Some people think that borrowing money to buy 12 new submarines or to cut corporate taxes is a good idea. Well, I've got stronger views about those questions than I do about whether you should borrow money to buy a car or not. For me, the questions of whether we should spend $50 billion to buy some subs or $60 billion on tax cuts still simply revolve around what else we could do with the money, what the long-run benefits of those choices are, and whether we could get something simpler for less money. And while it's easy for politicians to paint them as issues of good or bad or right and wrong, the fact is there's no right thing for a society to invest in. Like deciding whether you should spend money on family holiday or private school fees, there's no simple answer. For most of us, the discussion requires nuance. But again, that's exactly what our public debate has been stripped of.
Just because you are disadvantaged educationally doesn't mean you're dumb, doesn't mean you're not capable of being Prime Minister or whatever of Australia. What you need is assistance often to get there.
We're now joined on The Lucky Country by Jane Caro. Jane's had an extensive and diverse career, starting out in marketing, being a writer, now documentary filmmaker, and of course wrote a book called The Stupid Country. So we really had to get her here onto The Lucky Country. Jane, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Richard.
Jane, do you think that spending money on education is a good investment for a country?
I think it's probably one of the best investments that a country can make. We know, for example, that the money you spend, particularly in very early childhood, returns on investment like just about no other investment, particularly starting prenatally with women that we know are at risk of having children who have the kind of life trajectory that, you know, people talk about, make documentaries about, and, you know, worry about and cost disproportionately the community throughout their lives. So we know that kind of investment makes a real difference to the future. And of course, if you work with one woman and educate her in parenting and literacy and all that, it pays off for every subsequent child without any further investment. And of course, investing in public education is probably the thing that transformed the West into the West, because we you can't have a functioning democracy without a well-educated citizenry. You know, you have to educate your voters if you are going to have a functioning democracy, because in the end, they make all the decisions. So there is no greater investment, I think.
Wow, you make it seem like it's got so much going for it. I'm an economist. We love a bit of cost-benefit analysis. You seem to have a lot of evidence to suggest that there's a lot of benefits from education. It must be easy to talk politicians who talk endlessly about the need to grow the economy and to make society strong and stable. It must be easy to talk them into putting more money into education then.
Well, it is if you're a fee-charging school that's incredibly luxuriously resourced. You seem to have no trouble at all in talking politicians into giving you bucket loads of money. In fact, they practically fall over themselves in their attempt to do so, even so-called progressive governments. The very first thing the Daniel Andrews Labor government did in Victoria was put in place a 25% public subsidied Catholic schools, which is just ridiculous, and warped to Gonski, the original Gonski model. So it always bamboozles me that governments, particularly those that like to talk about themselves as being fiscally responsible, love to throw large amounts of money at very already very wealthy and luxuriously resourced schools with many different avenues for raising more funds. I mean, you talk about economists liking a return on investment. It absolutely boggles the mind what the return on investment is of giving money to the top 5% of private schools in Australia is. They have not become more accessible. Their fees have not come down. Their results have not gone up because they were already very good because they're educating the, you know, the very top of the socioeconomic status kids, and we know they're the kids that do best the world over, regardless of the kind of school. We really throw money at them. However, if you're up against a public school, you're going to have to beg and plead. You are going to have to fight, and you are going to be made ashamed of needing that money.
And do you think that in Australia we're spending enough money on education? Do we just need to reallocate? Do we need to chop the pie up, or do we need to grow the pie? Which is it?
Spending on education is probably one of those endless things. If someone could come up with, this is exactly the right amount of money you should spend on education for a particular country, I'm sure they'd win the Nobel Prize.
Well, it depends on how many swimming pools and rifle ranges you think a school needs, I suppose.
Exactly. Well, I think the point about it is, Australia is a reasonably good funder of education, but the figures I saw, now I think these probably were before Gonski, to be fair to them, but the figures I saw said that we were the third highest funders of private education in the OECD and the third lowest funders of public education. Well, that's the wrong way around. And that is what we have to fix if we want to do something about what, you know, is always called the long tail, and that is the persistent group of underachievers that have dogged the Australian education system for a very long time. We don't spend the money on the right things, and we don't spend the money in the right schools. And Gonski 2.0 is not really going to help with that. There is some more money going to public schools, but they've tied the funding via legislation so that 80% of the school resource standard, so every school is now supposed to be resourced to a set standard, 80% of that standard will be provided to private schools by the richest arm of government, the federal government, and 80% of the school resource standard is supposed to be provided to state schools by the state governments, which are the most cash-strapped arm of government. This gives, of course, poorer states like the Northern Territory and Tasmania a much tougher road to hoe, because you're a poorer state because you have more poor people in it, and that means you have more poor children, which means they're more expensive to teach, which means you actually need more money, and you've already got a poor state government supposedly being able to fill that gap. So it is totally arse about.
What could go wrong? We talk a lot about funding of schools, quite rightly, but we don't talk nearly as much about the regulation of private schools. And a lot of people are shocked to learn that publicly funded private schools are free to expel a girl because she's pregnant, or sack a teacher because they got divorced, or any a number of practices which would be considered discriminatory, but we have specific exemptions in our anti-discrimination laws to allow publicly funded private schools to undertake. Have you encountered these problems?
Yes. I mean, they come up a lot. Indeed, I think it comes as a shock to a lot of students who are studying to be teachers when they realise that if they go into the Catholic or the private system or other kinds of religious schools, they have no recourse to the Anti-Discrimination Act, and that they can be fired if, for example, they're divorced and then they remarry, or a school may decide that they don't want them to be living in sin. Or, I mean, I can see some logic behind saying, oh, we're a religious school and we have this particular ethos. But the point is, they don't have to nominate the grounds on which they discriminate. So it's kind of free-floating and they can decide to discriminate or not. So if a gay physics teacher comes along and there's a chronic shortage of physics teachers at the moment, they might take that one, and then if a straight one came along, they could just fire the gay physics teacher and replace them. They could do that. I'm not saying they have, but they could. They don't have to nominate and they don't have to tell anyone. So I think if they're going to have the exemption, they should have to nominate on what grounds they want an exemption. So it could be sexual orientation, it could be marital status, it could be reproductive status, it could be who knows what, speaking in tongues, whatever it is. They should have to nominate that, and they should have to say on all job ads and all prospectus and all advertising, we discriminate on the basis of, so that people don't waste time applying for jobs that they're never going to get, and so that parents are fully informed that a school they're paying money to may choose not the best teacher, but the teacher that isn't gay.
So you're suggesting that at a bare minimum we should be informing employees and informing customers of the private school of the grounds on which they discriminate. I mean, that sounds very libertarian. It's hard to believe that conservatives wouldn't want to have a well-functioning market with good information provided to customers.
It is hard to believe, isn't it? It's also hard to believe that they're so happy to distort a market, which is exactly what they're doing in the private public education situation. Because by publicly subsidising private schools as well as public schools, they are totally distorting any kind of level playing field or any ability. I mean, they talk about choice, parental choice, which is a classic free market speak. But they've failed to remember that most parents have very little choice and many have no choice at all. And, of course, no children have any choice. We constantly in Australia talk about education as if it was about rewarding and punishing parents. So, you know, I'm told that parents make sacrifices to send their children to private schools and that they're very invested in their children's education and therefore they should be rewarded for that, the implication being that public school parents are slack-asses who don't care. But actually, education has nothing to do with whether you have a good or a worthy or a self-sacrificing parent. Education is about children, and children are of equal value, whether they were lucky in the lottery of birth or unlucky. But no, in Australia, we like to use our education funding to help those children who were more fortunate when they were born and to further hinder those children who were less fortunate when they were born. It absolutely infuriates me.
Oh, I think you're being a bit harsh, Jane. I think those children should have chosen to have better off parents.
That's right. It's all their own fault, the losers.
Well,
yes. It's a very weird way of looking at the world to use an education system to really subsidise inherited privilege and yet somehow call that a market-based or free choice system, it's the exact opposite.
Well, as we're coming to realise on this show, unfortunately, the lucky country is certainly lucky for some, but perhaps not for others. So,
exactly right.
But Jane, we're lucky to have you on today. If people are interested, I hear one of your new documentaries is already up on iView.
Yes, it's The Staff Room, which is about teachers in public and in a Catholic high school. And it's three-parter and it's on ABC iView, shown in ABC Compass.
Well, I choose to go and watch that. Thank you very much.
Good on you, Richard.
Thanks, Jane.
Funding should be needs-based. Who can argue with that? This is a fair approach. Now, we've obviously got to get to that point as soon as we can. We're allowing 10 years to do so, and that is why during that 10 years, some schools will advance at different rates to others.
Now I'm joined by Chris Fry for our Sensible Centre segment. Chris is a long-time Canberra resident, lobbyist, and usually described as being well to the right of my good self. Chris Fry, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country. What do you think? Do private schools get too much money, or maybe we're not giving them enough?
Look, there's a genuine argument about the level of funding in aggregate. There's also a more interesting argument, I think, about the division within the different categories. I'm not expert enough to say whether private schools get too much or too little. Certainly, there's a lot of anomalies, which is what I think need to be addressed. And there are certainly some cases where per capita spending is completely out of whack between various schools. So In that regard, I'm very pro-redistribution, but I don't know the specifics beyond that.
Look, if a school's got an indoor swimming pool and an indoor archery range, is that proof that perhaps it's getting too much money from the taxpayer?
It would certainly be suggestive of that, which is my view.
But in principle, you think private schools should be getting taxpayer support?
Oh, yes. No, they should be getting some. There's absolutely no doubt. I don't believe in the full voucher system. That is clearly not neither fair nor efficient, I don't think. But certainly, all parents, in my view, are entitled to get some public assistance. The question is the relative levels, and as I say, it's got to be based on need, and of course everyone perceives need differently.
And if a private school is getting public money, should a private school have to act in accordance with public school values or society's values? For example, do you think it's okay for a private school that gets taxpayers' money to be free to expel a student for being pregnant or sack a teacher for living in sin?
Certainly, people are allowed to have their own views, and indeed they're allowed, I think, to teach within reasonable limits differing things. But you do not suspend basic rights simply because of the sort of views of the owner of an institution. So if a school says, well, I don't like your sexual orientation if you're a teacher, that is none of their business in my view, and they should not be allowed to do that. And that's just in general. If they're taking substantial amounts of taxpayers' money, no, everyone should have the same broad rules. There can be some variations. For example, if you want to wear your hair a certain way or you know, some kind of religious thing like that.
So are you saying it's okay for private schools to teach certain religious values but to not practice them?
In my view, yes. I'm not a religious person at all, but I don't mind if, for example, let's take the Sikh religion where you know, you're not allowed to cut hair. To me, that's silly, but to other people, that's important, and I have no problem with that. But that does not extend to cutting away the basic human rights of either workers or indeed the children.
And in terms of that, I mean, you know, we've got John Howard running around at the moment saying we must protect religious freedoms, we must protect religious freedoms. But I haven't heard much debate about what that means in the school sector. Do you think that the current campaign around in reinforcing religious freedoms as part of the same-sex marriage debate has got implications for what we should or shouldn't be talking about in schools and indeed how private schools should be behaving?
Well, I think we do. It looks to me like they're attempting to broaden whatever substantial and probably unjustified exemptions there are now. Certainly, I'm happy for this area to be looked at, but not in the context of broadening it. Probably to limit it would be my assessment.
Well, let's not tell John Howard that. Chris Fry, I'm afraid we've agreed with each other far more than usual today, but thanks so much for coming into the Sensible Centre yet again.
Look, thanks for having me, and I'm sure we can fix that next week.
Thanks, Chris.
Bye-bye.
The clearest evidence that Conservatives don't really hate debt and don't really think that incurring debt is evidence that anyone's living beyond their means is that they love HECS. The Higher Education Contribution Scheme requires young people to borrow tens of thousands of dollars to pay for their undergraduate degree. Who lends them all this money to help them live beyond their means? Who makes it possible for them to be so irresponsible? Well, of course, it's the government that issues HECS debts. Similarly, in justifying taxpayer support for elite private schools, some politicians are quick to point to examples of middle-income parents who borrow tens of thousands of dollars to pay for those exclusive school fees. Conservatives never accuse parents who borrow money to send their kids to private schools of living beyond their means. It's not right or wrong to send your kids to private school. It's not right or wrong to borrow money for the school fees or for HECS. These are just decisions that we make, either as individuals or as communities. There are better and worse things to spend money on, but we can't all agree what they are, and we never will. But if we have a sensible public debate, a debate that actually allows some nuance, then perhaps we could do a better job of collectively spending money on the things we agree are collectively important and leave people alone to spend their private money on whatever it is that they think is best for them or their family. It's not a complicated idea, but it's not black and white. And unfortunately, Australian public debate has become so binary that we can't really have a sensible conversation anymore. Except, of course, here on The Lucky Country. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode. The Lucky Country is a Schwartz Media production brought to you by Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. You can email us on theluckycountry@schwartzmedia.com.au. The show's produced by Andy Hazel. I'm Richard Dennis, and I'll be back with another edition of The Lucky Country next week. Thanks for joining us.